We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Near 90 degrees. Overnight low temperatures will range from the mid-50s in Wisconsin to near 70 in southern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny with a high of 85. The wind light and from the east tonight, mostly clear. The low 57. The wind will be light and out of the southeast. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 82 and a light southeast wind. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy. The low 62. The wind out of the east from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high of 85 and a southeast wind from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday night through Friday night, partly cloudy. We'll see lows around 70 and highs in the low 90s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-70s to the low 80s, and sunshine was reported throughout the two states. At Rockford and O'Hare, 75, Bloomington, 76, Mattoon, 80, Carbondale, 81, 76 at South Bend in Lafayette, 77, Indianapolis checked in with 79, and at Terre Haute, it was 80. Willard Airport reported a mostly sunny sky at the top of the hour, the temperature 78, the dew point 57, the relative humidity 48%, the wind light and variable, the barometric pressure 30.05 and falling. And at 12:38, 81 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. North Carolina's Outer Banks took some of the hardest pounding from Hurricane Irene. While the cleanup has begun, damage is still being assessed. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Manteo, North Carolina.
Collington is a small community on the sound side of North Carolina's Outer Banks. Yesterday, Chris Merritt, a fisherman, had just hauled his boat back from a neighbor's yard.
This boat here was sitting right here, and this morning it was down there, laid up against that house. Trailer and the boat, whole mess turned sideways and slapped their wooden addition on their house.
Merritt's boat appears to be all right. The same can't be said of his home.
Everything I own is ruined.
Come on, get here. Come on.
I'm trying to salvage my pictures.
Yeah, you got your pictures out here to dry.
Yeah, trying to dry out. See how the walls are buckled on the walls when it's gotten wet?
Yeah, and you can see a water line there.
For nearly 36 hours, Irene pounded Collington and other communities along North Carolina's coast. In this area, wind did little damage. But as the hurricane moved north, the storm surge rushed into the sounds and inlets. Several feet of water flooded Collington, Manteo, Juan Cheese, and many other Outer Banks communities. At Billy's Seafood in Collington, owner Tommy Beasley is working with a group of friends to sweep out all the mud and water the storm surge carried in.
40 years of work and 40 inches of water. We're done. All the new equipment, everything we bought all this year is all ruined, all underwater.
Beasley says he doesn't have insurance. His policy was canceled a decade ago, and he's never found another underwriter. He's hoping for assistance from the federal government and the state, but is worried they'll focus on affluent beach communities, not on trailer homes and seafood stands on the Sound.
The Oceanside's made for the tourists. The real people live on the backside.
North Carolina Governor Bev Perdue toured the area yesterday and said she would not forget about the people on the Sound side. The state's already received a federal disaster declaration, and the governor says she'll soon be submitting a request for federal aid to help rebuild the state's battered communities. Greg Allen, NPR News, Manteo, North Carolina.
An aging anti-corruption crusader in India has ended a two-week fast. Anna Hazare and the government reached a compromise on dealing with officials and politicians who demand bribes. Millions were riveted by the standoff. Elliot Hannon filed this report from New Delhi.
It was a party atmosphere in the Indian capital on Sunday morning, with tens of thousands showing support for Indian anti-corruption activist Anna Hazare. Amidst the song and dance, two young girls quietly handed the 74-year-old a cup of coconut water, and he put an end to his 13-day fast. After a dramatic special session of parliament on Saturday, the political stalemate between Hazare and the government ended in compromise. For protesters like Bayush Bansal, it was a victorious compromise.
So it is just a beginning, which Anna has started, and we all have to get together and take it forward.
Hazare and his supporters launched their protests 2 weeks ago, demanding that the government create an independent investigative agency to combat corruption. Hazare began fasting and said he would continue until the government accepted his demands. He wanted a strong agency that could investigate anyone, from the prime minister to the lowest levels of the Indian bureaucracy. Despite its populist appeal, there were concerns on all sides about the constitutional implications of the investigative agency, as well as its impact on the democratic process. Rahul Gandhi, secretary of India's ruling Congress Party, addressed Parliament on Friday.
A process divorced from the machinery of an elected government that seeks to undo the checks and balances created to protect the supremacy of Parliament, of this House, sets a dangerous precedent for our democracy.
Throughout the week, demands for government action against corruption grew louder. Concerns about Hazare's health also added pressure to find a compromise. On Saturday, both sides relented. Opposition leader Arun Jaitley spoke to Indian news channel NDTV about the process.
There are a lot of things that in the course of our dialogue with the team Anna, that they also saw a lot of reason. And therefore, between the political establishment and them, I think the dialogue yielded much on both sides. Both gave up some and both agreed to some.
Breaking the stalemate, a non-binding resolution was passed. It allows for investigation of lower levels of bureaucracy and establishes oversight agencies in each state, but excludes the prime minister and judiciary. As the fast ended, the outcome was celebrated, but that wasn't the only victory. Vikas Chowdhury is an MBA student at the rally.
Now I think we have a scope, we have a hope that everything should be done in the right manner in our country. I think this kind of rally, or this Anna Hazare, especially this rally, work as the generation awakers.
At the rally, protesters like journalist Honey Chadha had a new appreciation for their political power.
The politicians are corrupted, so my politely request from them, please don't mess with us because we are dangerous, because we are Annas.
Chadha says he's confident the government won't mess with Anna Hazare and his followers when it comes to following through with its promises. For NPR News, I'm Elliot Hannon in New Delhi.
In Cleveland, Ohio, officials have launched an innovative program to deal with the foreclosures blighting the region. They're reselling marketable homes and tearing down the rest. Cities have been tearing down crumbling, vacant houses for decades. The money for municipal demolition bills usually comes out of city budgets, but in Cleveland, they're getting banks to pay for the demolition as well. More from Mari Saito of member station WCPN.
Bill Beavers has lived on Cleveland's Dove Street since 1967. But on a recent sunny morning, Beavers is sitting on a neighbor's front porch, watching something he has never seen on his block before. Across the street, a huge excavator is tearing through the front facade of a two-story wooden house. The top half of the house, windows, exterior wall and all, folds as easily as cut weeds and tumbles to the ground. You can see the rooms, much like in a dollhouse.
Oh, it's good to see it, to see them tear these old structures down, because nobody wants to move in them. It costs too much to fix them up, you know.
The house went into foreclosure 2 years ago. When the family moved out, vandals stole the circuit panel and pipes. Other houses on the block are nicely kept up. But the street is in the 44105 zip code, which in 2007 had the dubious distinction of garnering the highest foreclosure rate in the nation. Saturated with foreclosures, the lender that took back the house couldn't unload it for even $5,000. Gus Frangos heads the Cuyahoga County Land Bank that oversees these demolitions.
Property like that on a street that's otherwise relatively stable but depressed market probably needs to come down because it has, you know, way too much need on the inside. If you take these pockmarks out, all of a sudden you stabilize the street a little bit.
When the land bank started 2 years ago, Frangos thought the group would have to pay its demolition bill from its own budget. But the economy worsened and the foreclosures piled up, and lenders stuck with crumbling houses found themselves on the hook in Cleveland Housing Court for hundreds of thousands of dollars of code violations. The Cuyahoga County Land Bank offered lenders a deal. We'll take your worst houses if you pay to knock them down. This year, some of the country's biggest lenders like Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, and Fannie Mae will help pay for half of the land bank's 700 scheduled demolitions. Lenders pay between $3,500 to $7,500 per house. Wells Fargo's Russ Cross says it's a sensible and responsible business plan.
We want to make loans on an ongoing basis. To do so, we need stable to rising home values. We've got to do whatever we can to protect home values in neighborhoods.
Some lenders are looking at starting similar programs in Detroit, Chicago, and Milwaukee. Fannie Mae's P.J. McCarthy says the government-controlled mortgage giant has been donating properties and demolition funds to the Cuyahoga County Land Bank since 2009 because keeping the houses just doesn't make sense.
They're not going to sell on the market for much more than a few thousand dollars, and our costs in marketing those properties and in preserving them generally exceed the costs, and so the economics of the transaction make sense, as well as the intent of the land bank to reduce supply and stabilize the neighborhood.
Dealing with foreclosures is a huge headache for financial institutions. RealtyTrack, an online marketplace for bank-owned property, counted more than 1.6 million foreclosures in the U.S. in July. RealtyTrack's Rick Sharga says demolition programs like Cleveland's only start to address the backlog.
But eliminating a handful of these houses really isn't going to be a cure-all in and of itself. It's one step in a much longer process that's going to be required before the housing market comes back.
And in the meantime, cities have to figure out what to do with the newly vacant land. In South Euclid, an eastern suburb of Cleveland, building inspector Rick Loconte is walking on a brick path through small plots of tomatoes, eggplants, and sunflowers, and remembers what used to be here.
The house was so far gone, we couldn't fix it up and get any kind of a return. So we demolished the house and we put in this community garden, and it's now become a source of community pride.
Loconte concedes there are more vacant lots than demand for community gardens. Municipalities are also offering newly vacated land to neighbors as side lots and putting other plots away for if and when the housing market improves here. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito in Cleveland.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 29th of August, 2011. Today is the anniversary of the death. We don't know much about his birth. Edmund Hoyle, 1769. He was born in 1671 or 72, possibly in Yorkshire, England. He may have been a lawyer. We're not sure. What we do know is that he was the first technical writer on card games. He lived in London. He taught high society.